Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And good morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Beth Pike. It's Monday. And on today's broadcast, our host, Allie Catherine Bush, is going to talk with Emily Haim, and that is the program director at the Literacy of KC, and they'll be talking about programs and services available. In the second half, we're going to replay an interview that we had where Craig LeBeau was the host, and he did an interview with Sister Helen Brijon, and they're going to talk about why she opposes the death penalty. You'll also want to stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. But now it is time for Allie and her guests.
Thank you for tuning in.
I'm Allie Catherine Bush, and my guest today is Emily Haim. She's with Literacy KC, and I'd like to welcome you to the show. And would you speak about your organization and how you are connected and what you do?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me here this morning, Allie. So my name's Emily, and I'm the programs manager at Literacy KC. We are an adult literacy nonprofit. Our main goal is to get everyone reading at a proficient rate so they can have the lifestyle and the jobs that they'd like to pursue. And I've been with Literacy KC for 3 years, and we've seen some remarkable changes in that time.
Okay. I'd like to have our listeners get ready, get your pencils and pens and paper out so that you can take some notes on where they're located, their phone numbers, so you can get in touch. And I'd like Emily to tell you where they're located, the phone number, and website.
Yeah, so our address is 211 West Armor Boulevard. We're right in Midtown Kansas City between Main and Broadway on Armor inside the American Red Cross building. So that's our address. Our phone number is 816-333-9332. So if you know anyone who wants to improve their reading and writing skills, or if you yourself would like to improve your reading and writing skills, as long as you're 16 years old or older, you'd be welcome to come and join our program. We know that there are a lot of folks in the Kansas City Metro who still don't yet have a high school diploma or may struggle reading even basic things like a prescription or a job application. So if that applies to you or any of your friends, have them give us a call at 816-333-9332.
Okay, and if those people are ready right now that are listening in, here are the websites and the info site where you can get on your computers and get in touch.
Yeah, and I welcome everybody to check out our website. We actually launched our new website at the beginning of last month, and it's been reorganized. So even if you've been a longtime Literacy KC fan, you should absolutely check us out again at www.literacykc.org. And that's where you can find information about our programs, our upcoming events, and ways that you can get involved, whether as a volunteer tutor, a donor, or a general community supporter.
Okay. Emily, I'd like for you to speak about the mission and the vision of your organization. I'm so excited about this organization because I am an advocate of this.
I love that. So our vision is really literacy for all. We want to make sure that everyone has the access to the reading skills that they need. And we do that through community collaboration and advocacy and direct services. So that means we actually teach classes for adults, as well as work with our community partners. And anytime we get the opportunity to advocate for adult learners, we absolutely do.
Okay. And you have volunteers that do a lot of this work.
Absolutely. We would be lost without our community volunteers. So go ahead and picture this. A typical Literacy Kansas City classroom would have maybe 12 to 15 adult learners. Mm-hmm. And we know that adults have very different needs than a regular typical classroom because adults come to the table with so many background experiences. They come to the table with so many educational experiences. And so maybe they'd had some trauma in their previous education, or maybe there's a specific skill gap that happens to be missing for a person. And adults we're busy. We've got kids, we've got families, we've got jobs. So the learners we're working with are oftentimes heads of households, and they have to balance so many things. So if you're learning as an adult, you don't want to just go into a classroom and sit and listen to a lecture. You want it to be interactive. You want it to be focused on you and your individual needs. And so that's really where our volunteers come in. So we keep our classes small, about 12 to 15, but then within the class, there are volunteer tutors who can really help the students on their individual goals, whatever it is that they're working towards. And all of our classes are led by qualified staff instructors, because we know that if teaching reading is a very specialized skill set, and having someone who is either a reading specialist or a retired teacher or who has experience and training in the reading process is so much better for the educational outcomes for our students than when we rely on community volunteers alone. But those volunteers are critical for student retention and making people feel like their individual goals and needs are being met within the classroom. So that really launched our big switch. You know, we've been around for 30 years, and for 28 of those years, we did one-to-one tutoring. So is that something where a volunteer would come and get trained and then get matched with a student one-to-one. But it was really difficult to keep up with the demand. We'd have students on our wait list for over 9 months at a time before we could match them with a qualified volunteer. And so by switching to the classroom model, we were able to see more students more quickly. And something really remarkable occurred. We now have these really great little pockets in our classes. And so they turn into their own little families. And we see people who are, oh, you take the morning class, I'll take the evening class, and I'll watch your kids while you're in class. Mm-hmm. And then when you're in class, I'll take care of your children and pick them up from school. And that's the type of community that's being built within these classrooms. And that's critical for success.
Okay, as far as the classes are set up, is it every day or how often do they come?
That's a great question. We go to class 2 times a week for 1.5 to 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Or we have some learners who come for the full 3 hours on a Saturday. And we work really hard to have a mix of daytime, evening, weekend. And we also work with partner agencies, so that way our office isn't the only place where our classes take place. Mm-hmm. We have classes at St. James United Methodist Church, okay, at Catholic Charities downtown. We've worked with libraries. Kansas City Parks and Rec has hosted our classes at various community centers like Brush Creek and Greg Kleist Community Center down in the historic Jazz District. So we're working very hard to meet the need where it is, both academically and geographically, because we know that transportation is a barrier in Kansas City and for a lot of our learners.
Okay. Is any of this work done at home with some of the students?
Absolutely. I'm sure our students are all expected to do, you know, at least 20 minutes of reading a day outside of class. And so that keeps things fresh, and there's instructor assigned homework. So maybe it's a writing assignment. Maybe it's a chapter from the book they're reading in their book club. We also use an online software program for our C&D classes, which are kind of our pre-high set classes for our higher level students. And this online software program can be logged into anytime, anywhere, as long as you have internet access. And that actually helps speed up how quickly you can read. So it's really neat to watch our students using that. And anyone who has access to a computer outside of class is expected to do at least 2 hours on our reading software program. Okay. And that's something that's so neat for a lot of our adult learners, is the technology like that wasn't around when I was in school learning how to read, and I'm not that old. And so having the opportunity to explore learning to read using technology and integrating those digital computer skills is so important, because literacy in 2016 involves a computer. It involves digital literacy. It's very different than literacy even in the 1980s when we were founded. So making sure that we're incorporating all the newest technologies to help our students reach their goals, but also making sure that computer access and digital inclusion is a goal for all of our students and for our organization. And we've been very fortunate to have a digital inclusion fellow from Google Fiber for the past 2 years.
So
we have a full-time person who is dedicated solely to making sure that our students have access to the internet, have devices, and most importantly, have the training and the knowledge and the skills that they need to navigate online and all the things that you can learn with that.
Okay, and as far as the adults that have been attending these classes, for the listeners out there that might be a little nervous about, you know, their age group, what typically is the age of those classes?
Yeah, so you have to be at least 16 to join our services. We do have some 16, 17, 18-year-olds who do our program in addition to being enrolled in high school. And right now, I think our oldest learner is 83 years old.
Oh,
so
wow.
As long as you'll come, we'll take you. And I would say we have a really good mix. Most of our students fall between the age of 35 and 45, but we do have quite a few who are much older. A lot of times we'll see grandparents who will come to us. I know there's one student who, she actually sits on our student advisory council, which is our way for students to share their voice and share their perspective and really shape our programs. And she came to our program because her granddaughter recognized that she wasn't reading her the actual words in the story. She was turning the pages and making it up as she went along, which is still a great thing to do. If you can't read, make up the story, look at the pictures. That's good for your child. But the granddaughter had called her out and said, "Grandma, I want you to read me the truth." And the granddaughter had figured out Literacy Kansas City, and she was the one who called us on behalf of her grandmother. And she's been with us for about, I want to say, 2 years now, and she can absolutely read her granddaughter the truth now. And so it's really remarkable to see how, regardless of what age you're at, regardless of what your situation in life is, there's always something you can do. And we believe in being lifelong learners.
Right.
You know, it doesn't stop when you get your high school diploma. It doesn't stop when you get your PhD. You should always be learning and always striving to see what's out there and just be a curious learner.
I know I enjoy reading with my grandchildren. I have two girls and a boy, and the little four-year-old just turned four-year-old over the weekend. She likes to be read to when she goes to bed. So
absolutely.
That's a good bonding, you know.
It is.
For families.
It's a great bonding for families. It's a great way to kind of quiet down at the end of the day. When you read before bed, it actually helps your children sleep better through the night, which is something all parents are looking for. Yeah, that's really wonderful. And, you know, we also care a lot about how families read together. And that's why at Literacy Kansas City, we have several different programs. You know, the crux of what we do, the core of our program is Ticket to Read, which is our adult literacy classes.
Right.
But a lot of the reason adults come to us is we see a lot of parents who want to be able to help their children in school. And that kind of led to the development of our Let's Read program, which is our family reading program. And so that's something where, you know, if you didn't grow up having a bedtime story read to you every night, you may not know exactly, well, how do I read with my kid? Or my child never sits down. My child is running around. There's never a good time to have lap reading time. And so Let's Read really empowers parents to know all sorts of different ways that you can incorporate reading into your everyday life. If you're riding on the bus and you see a big golden arch of M for McDonald's, all of a sudden that child is seeing a symbol, seeing a letter, and connecting it with meaning.
Right.
And that's a pre-literacy skill. You can do that at the bus stop. You can do that at the grocery store. And so Let's Read is a really great program that we offer, typically either at community apartments, housing centers, or elementary schools like we are this fall. And that's just a one-hour fun time for parents and children to play together, laugh together, and most importantly, read together. And parents leave with tips on how they can incorporate reading in the home, and everybody gets a brand new children's book. And those are award-winning, culturally responsive books. So that way our students can start building their own home library, and parents can feel like they are the first and best teacher for their child, which we know to be true.
Okay. I'd like for you to give us a little background on Literacy Kansas City. A brief history on how it got started, who this lady was, who started the whole thing.
Yeah, so we started in the basement of a church about 31 years ago.
Okay.
And it all came from an individual who saw that there were a lot of adults in Kansas City who were struggling to read. And at the time, there was a great man by the name of Frank Laubach. And so if you look across the United States, there are lots of LABAC literacy councils. And that was our original name when we first incorporated as an organization. And Frank LABAC really had the idea that each one can teach one. And one-to-one tutoring is the way to meet the adult literacy need, which at the time, and based on the research that was available, that was the best approach. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we trucked along kind of under that one-to-one volunteer tutoring model. I guess, you know, 5 years later, they were able to hire staff members, and the organization just grew and grew. And it was kind of in seeing that we weren't able to meet all of the students who were calling us. We had a wait list of students who wanted to be matched with a volunteer tutor, that we weren't able to meet that need. And so in about 2012, 2013, our director of programs at the time, Jillian Helm, who is now our executive director, she really went to the drawing board and said, what else can we be doing differently? And so through lots of research, through a program that we partnered with Penn Valley Community College, we saw that a classroom model might be the right way to go. And with adults who have low literacy skills, there's absolutely a stigma. Nobody wants to step up and say, I can't read as an adult. There's a lot of shame that goes into that. And so we really feared that if we lost the security of a one-to-one relationship, we would lose our students. And what we've seen since we made the transition into the classroom model in January 2015 is actually a higher retention with our students, because all of a sudden there's that peer learning. And we know that humans are social creatures, so we love to learn from one another. And when you're inside that classroom, you see somebody who has skills just a little bit better than yours, and that gives you something to aspire to. And most importantly, you see someone who can share that experience of, I too have struggled with reading, and we're in this together, and you are not alone. And that's something that if anyone's listening today, I want them to know, if you do struggle with reading and writing skills, there are 225,000 adults in the Kansas City metro who read at less than an eighth grade level. You are not alone. It is a community issue, and it affects more people than you would assume. And you never know just by looking at somebody if they can read or not. And it's something where our adult learners have great coping mechanisms. So I will say our adult literacy students are the most charming individuals you will ever meet, because you have to find ways to get around life without being able to interact with text. And so...
Okay, I noticed that at one time back in 2008, you almost had to close up, but then you got help.
Yeah, absolutely. So adult literacy, you know, we depend so much on our community supporters. And in 2008, you know, the economy wasn't in a great place. We had a few grants that didn't come through. And we were very fortunate that our board of directors reached deep into their pockets and pulled out what we needed to continue thriving as an organization. And I guess with that, I'll make a little pitch. We are getting ready to start our end of the year campaign. And again, we have the most fabulous board of directors who are so supportive, who have already raised $25,000 of their own dollars to be a matching gift. So if anyone's interested in donating, you can visit us at www.literacykc.org. And between now and the end of the year, your gift will be matched up to the $25,000 grant for, or $25,000 from our board of directors. And in addition to that, we also have another grant for $25,000 for matching gifts. So you can triple your dollar with any gift you make between now and the end of the year. So we absolutely rely on our community partners. We absolutely rely on our donors. And it's an important issue. And we thank everybody who's able to spend their generosity and their time and their talent with Literacy KC.
Okay, you have some important people that are in your organization, such as Kevin. Could you pronounce that name?
Yeah, Kevin Darohanian.
Okay.
He is one of our AmeriCorps Vistas at Literacy KC. And Kevin, I can thank him for leading me to you this morning. He has done so much for our marketing and our communication and outreach. And so if you are ever interested in having myself or Jillian Helm, our executive director, come out and talk to your organization or share more about what we do, Kevin is absolutely the person to get in contact with. And just like anyone on our staff, you can be reached at 816-333-9332.
Okay. And the other person besides yourself?
So it would be Jillian Helm, who is our executive director. And as our executive director, Jillian is so incredibly important to our organization by creating the vision of us, of what we can be. And Jillian can also be reached at the same number, 333-9332.
Okay, and we need to mention what the subjects are that people can, you know, contact you for to let you know what they're lacking in.
Yeah.
Could you pinpoint what those different groups are?
So we focus a lot on reading and writing, but we know that literacy is so much more than just reading and writing. Literacy is also basic math skills. So our adult literacy students are able to enroll in small math classes or math tutoring sessions, and those are completely run by volunteers. We have 40 students who are doing math tutoring this fall, which is great. And beyond math, reading, and writing, we also have digital literacy classes. Because like I said, working a computer, that's just as important as reading and writing in 2016. Everything is online. So
right.
We know that having continued classes to work through that is really important.
Mm-hmm. At Jaws of Justice and Emily Hain with Literacy KC will give you some insight into some of the statistics that they have to show why it's so important for adults to continue their education.
Yeah, like I said, in the Kansas City Metro, we have 225,000 adults who are reading below an eighth grade level, and that comes from a federal survey. We also know that right now, 75% of individuals who are incarcerated haven't completed high school and can be classified as low literate. And most important, what I see every day at Literacy KC, in 2015, we averaged 41 phone calls every single month from adults who are seeking help. Mm-hmm. So if you want to improve your skills, if you want a safe environment to come back and get back in school before going to college, if you want to be able to read the truth to your grandchildren, give us a call at 816-333-9332.
Okay. You mentioned Jillian Helm, your executive director.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed with her background.
She is a very impressive woman.
Right. So this is something that she's working on daily.
Absolutely.
To help people.
And what I think is so inspiring about Jillian's leadership within our organization is not just that she cares about our clients, but she cares about building a sustainable organization. And she knows that we can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. So Jillian's constantly looking for services that complement our own. And it's through her leadership that we started working with Catholic Charities. It's through mm-hmm. her leadership that we started working with other community partners who bring those other necessary skills. You know, 43% of adults who are low literate live in poverty. Mm-hmm. So that means things like keeping food on the table, keeping the lights on are really difficult. And so through Jillian's leadership, she sought partnerships with Bishop Sullivan Center who can provide assistance if your lights are about to be shut off. Because, you know, we are reading experts, we're reading specialists, and we're really good at teaching folks how to read. Mm-hmm. But there's so much more to learning how to read, and there are so many barriers that individuals can come across. And through Jillian's leadership, she has consistently moved us in a direction that alleviates barriers to service by putting our sites out in the community so that way transportation isn't as much of a burden, or it's in a space where individuals already feel comfortable and ready to learn. Because one of the biggest barriers someone can face is just the fear of the unknown, the stigma of not knowing how to read as an adult. Mm-hmm. And so by making sure our classes are comfortable and welcoming, we really overcome that.
I see that Jillian has a wonderful background. She has a bachelor's in English literature, a minor in Spanish from Park University. She has did a lot of research in Latin America on government resources available to women, but she decided that being with Literacy KC was really what it was all about. So I can see where she has spent a lot of her time there.
Yeah, we're very lucky to have her. And I think, you know, going from that international focus to looking right here in our own community, you know, there's a lot we can do right here in Kansas City. There's a lot of important work that needs to be done. And Jillian definitely rolls up her sleeves and she gets to work.
Okay. Also, she has a master's degree in public administration with an emphasis on nonprofit management from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So I know you do a lot of work with UMKC.
We do. We definitely benefit from a lot of their expertise. So thank you so much for having me here today. I'm always happy to talk about our services and what we do. And if you are interested at all in getting involved, visit us online today at literacykc.org.
Okay. Thank you, Emily Hain with Literacy KC.
Now the calendar for November 6th. The Metropolitan Organization for Racial and Economic Equity, Missouri Issues Night, will reconvene on Monday, November 6th from 6 until 7:30 p.m. at Trinity United Methodist Church. That's located at 620 East Armor Boulevard in Kansas City, Missouri. Committees on access to health, criminal justice, education, immigration, and workforce infrastructure task force will be meeting, and all are welcome. The Black Archives of Mid-America is presenting the Horace M. Peterson Lecture, and that's a series featuring Dr. Sean Alexander on the Battle for Respect, Black Soldiers in World War I, Part 2. The event will be held on Thursday, November 10th, from 6 until 7:30 p.m. at the Black Archives of Mid-America. That's located at 1722 East 17th Terrace in Kansas City, Missouri. And the mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters are going to be having their monthly meeting on Saturday, November 12th. That will be held from noon until 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street in Kansas City, Missouri. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and you need advice or support, MISD has members that may help you. My name is Beth Bike, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on KKFI's website. That's kkfi.org. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Next week, David Bell will return with the second installment of his conversation with four generation of the Bibbs family. But up next is Craig and Sister Helen Prejean.
Hey, this is Craig Lubo, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice, and I have Sister Helen Prejean with us today, and we're going to be talking about death penalty. Sister Prejean wrote two books. One was Dead Man Walking, which was also made into a movie, and the other was Death of Innocence, and that was not made into a movie, is that right?
Not yet.
Okay.
But Dead Man Walking, also an opera, Dead Man Walking, which is very successful around the world. It's a modern opera, premiered in San Francisco in the year 2000, and it's going to be coming around here, I think, in the year 2017. And then Tim Robbins also wrote a play, stage play, for university and high school students.
Okay. When you got into this, you were in Louisiana.
Right.
And how did you initially get into this?
Well,
to being a spiritual advisor to inmates.
Okay. Well, I'm a Catholic nun, and first I was a teacher in a parochial school, St. Francis Marini, taught 7th and 8th graders in projects in New Orleans, because I had grown up in such white privilege. My daddy was a successful lawyer. We were separated from black people. It was during everything was segregated, and I never questioned it. And then I moved in at St. Thomas, and African-American people began to teach me about the other America, and all the rules were different. The way police treated people was different. You didn't have health care. You had to go to charity hospital. You went to public schools. You could get to be a junior in high school, and you couldn't read a third grade book. Everything was different, and I learned everything from them. And then while I was there, I was invited one day by a friend who worked in the Louisiana Prison Coalition office if I wanted to write to a man on death row. And I said, sure, I'll write to somebody on death row. And it all happened out of that.
And that was the guy in Louisiana, that was the first one you...
Right. His name was Patrick Saunier.
Okay.
And he and his brother Eddie were both in Angola, Louisiana State Penitentiary, which is 18,000 acres. It's made up of three former plantations. And it's a tough prison. And he was on death row, and I wrote him letters, and he wrote back, and then I went to visit him. And 2 years later, I ended up being with him, and he was looking at my face when he was killed in the electric chair. His crime was unspeakable. He and his brother had killed these two innocent teenage kids in cold blood. And I was horrified when I found out what they had done.
And did you serve as spiritual advisor to his brother, too?
Yeah, both of them. Okay. I figured while I'm making that long drive to Angola, I'd just soon see the brother, too. And so I ended up accompanying Eddie until he died, actually. He had two life sentences, and he died of a heart attack a year and a half ago. But his brother, Pat, was executed in the early morning hours, right after midnight of April 5th, 1984. And that changed my life, because I saw it close up of what it means to kill a human being.
And you talked, I heard you speak about the culture and how that relates and you related slavery to the culture of the death penalty. Tell us about that.
Well, it's, you know, the way you grow up and what your folks do, what the people in your neighborhood do, what the people in your church do. So like, for example, growing up in the Jim Crow days, I didn't have any personal friends who were African-American people because we were never in the presence of African-American. The only people I knew personally were Ellen and Jesse. I didn't even know their last names. Ellen worked in the house with Mama, and Jesse worked in the yard. And Daddy and Mama were nice to Ellen and Jesse. I mean, my daddy, who was also a businessman, knew real estate, he helped Ellen and Jesse get some property, get a house. He helped Jesse get a good job at the refinery in Baton Rouge, but never questioned the system and what it must mean for the dignity of people not to be able to drink at a fountain with other people simply because of the color of your skin. And our family would take these long trips in the summer. We'd get in the family station wagon and went through all the states, all 50 states, Canada, and you'd stop in restaurants to eat. You'd stop in motels at night to sleep. And then I'd thought of all these families. Imagine traveling with a family and you can't ever go into a restaurant or you can't even use a bathroom unless it's marked colored. Just what that must do to the dignity of a father of a family. And as the children learn as they grow up, simply because of the color of their skin, that they're considered inferior. And so later when I realized and it all came to me, but that's what culture does. Culture gives you eyes and gives you ears and just says, honey, that's the way we do things in the Deep South. And you believe it as a child because it's what you see all around you. So waking up is just really a big part of being an adult and being a responsible adult and being an active citizen is you go, wait a minute, look at that. So when I moved into the St. Thomas Housing Project, people were teaching me everything. Everything was different from what I had known. And I was ready to learn then. Say I'm reading. So that's when I read The Life of Martin Luther King. It's when I read The Life of Gandhi. It's when I read The Life of Dorothy Day, who was a Catholic in New York who started the Catholic worker houses for homeless people and hungry people after the Depression. And you begin to see people who begin to act, who take their faith and put it into action for justice. And then I began to learn about human rights. I learned from Amnesty International about inalienable human rights, the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That simply because you are human, these human rights are inalienable. They can't be alienated from you. And two of those basic rights are the right not to be tortured and the right not to be killed. And I began to learn all that. I began to watch lawyers come in, like into St. Thomas. Everybody belonged to, or everybody had public housing, and he had the New Orleans Housing Authority. And the people couldn't get the maintenance. Miss Eva, she had a leak in her bathroom for 2 years. She was in a wheelchair, and every time she'd stand up in her bathroom, she's in water. And she'd call for maintenance to come fix the leak in her bathroom. 2 years, they hadn't come. And people couldn't get services because they were looked down upon. They were welfare recipients and public housing. So here comes this young lawyer, Bill Quigley, a and he starts meeting with, and they form a tenants association, and he teaches them their rights. He said, look, the landlords, the public housing authorities have responsibilities, but as tenants, you have rights, you have responsibilities, so you have the right to go to them and just say our needs are not being met. Taught them how to organize. And that was the first public demonstration or march I was ever in, and I wasn't leading it. I was just there in solidarity with the people because they had a right to be able to get leaks fixed in their apartments. One time they had no lights, it was dark, crime was a problem, and just to stand with people to ask for their rights.
And when we talk about culture as it relates to death penalty and racism, do you sense that it's intentional racism in the Deep South? Or is it just that they just haven't been able to move past the culture that they had as children?
Okay, first I want to make the point that the racism and the death penalty is across the entire nation. When New Jersey had the death penalty, New York, when New Mexico, always you look and anybody sent to death row are always poor people because they can't get good defense. Mm-hmm. And 8 out of every 10 people sent to death row because they killed a white person. That's the way the racism shows up all over the nation, that we value the life of white people. We're outraged over the life of people because 90% of judges are white, 90% of district attorneys are white, 90% of juries are white. And I just think it's a human thing. We tend to identify with people who look like us. So there's great outrage and great fear when one like us is killed. And so that's when you see the death penalty being sought. When the stranger is killed, the one we consider the other, who's more foreign to us, and that's people of color for a lot of people. So when black people are killed, there's no outrage over their death. In fact, in prosecutors' offices, there's not even a blip on the radar screen. I learned that from St. Thomas. We had a murder victim support group. And some of the people, like Shirley Carr, she had 2 sons killed within six months of each other. And one of her boys, they didn't even send an investigator out. They just accept it. That's what those people do. There's no outrage over the death. And there's no full criminal investigation because the life isn't valued. So it isn't just a Deep South thing. And now we're seeing all across this country in the way the police, you know, that young black men are suspect. And all the studies are showing driving while black, police tend to stop black people more. I gave a talk at DePaul University in Chicago. This was in a sociology class at the university. And we just started talking about experiences, who had been stopped by police. And all the people in that class, if they were Asian, if they were Hispanic, if they were black, all of them talked about having experiences with the police. So it's like color-coded as a person of suspicion in our society. So we can't just think of it as the Deep South by any means. We all have that legacy in us.
How do we begin to change that culture?
First you wake up to it. In this sociology class, they were all waking up to it. And you read about it, and you learn about it, and you listen to others, and you share your experiences. And then when you can see, and now with, you know, video cameras and all that are in everybody's iPhone and cell phone, that we get having witnesses to what. But when I moved into St. Thomas, every young man in that community had bad experiences with the police. I never had a bad experience. Mm-hmm. I wasn't scared of policemen, but I'm a white woman, and I expect that they're going to help me. But the young black men, automatically suspicioned by the police, and a lot of them, some of them we witnessed one time from the front porch of Hope House. We witnessed a policeman throwing Bobby Leonard up against the car, and he yells out to us, two of us were on the porch, sisters, y'all are my witnesses, I got no drugs on me. They're going to try to plant drugs on me. And they haul him off in the police car. And there's no, you know, without any provocation, just because it's just endemic in us. So it's the way any time injustice is pointed out and we stand up against it as citizens and you write letters to the editor and you begin to raise the consciousness of people. Then the next thing you know, you begin to hear about reform in police departments. You begin to hear about there are going to be video cameras on the police cars to begin to hold them accountable. And that's how change happens.
When you're holding them accountable, though, what can we do to assure that they're screened before they're
even
hired?
Yeah, well, all those are part of reform. See, and as citizens begin to talk about this, as it gets into the consciousness in the community, they begin to do something. Like, look how the Chicago Tribune brought out about how the police were torturing people and putting them in the Cook County Jail, coercing confessions. And their journalists did that. They began to expose it. And then, next thing you know, I mean, soon the whole thing was busted open. An investigation was done. Some people were fired. New police chief put in, and reform happens.
And that was part of the basis why Governor Ryan commuted all the sentences.
I mean, and look, that's an interesting story because, you know, these innocence projects started in university students that are volunteers. They're not even lawyers. So at Northwestern, you had journalism students who got involved with this innocence project. And here's Governor Ryan. He had helped put the death penalty in as a Republican legislator. And he's governor, and they keep coming in his office. Governor, there's another innocent one. Governor, this is a person who was beaten by the police. Totally innocent. By the time he got to the 13th one, his conscience was moved. I talked to him. I met him several times in the course of that, you know, the road that he was on of awakening. And then he realizes how broken the thing was. He sent two reform packages to the Illinois legislature, and they rejected them both. And he knew he had power as governor to commute those sentences. And it was a very brave thing to do. He did that even though he knew one of those men on death row had killed in a very brutal way his friend and neighbor who lived next door to him. And he said, I certainly couldn't commute the sentences of everybody but him. So just like all those victims' families, when he commuted, he met with them. And of course, they've gotten brought into the cultural thing of this is how you get justice for your dead child or your father or whatever. And so they were very angry at him, saying, you can't do this, you're disrespecting us. But he saw it broader and he saw it deeper, that it was about all of us and that it was clearly broken.
And the people you've served as spiritual advisor to, and especially I'm getting at the ones who have been executed, were you convinced that any of them were innocent? Or?
Yeah, that's the second book I wrote. It's called The Death of Innocence. One was in Louisiana, Dobie Williams. He had an IQ of 65. Well, you read that case and just see how he was railroaded. Mm-hmm. All white jury. A white woman had been killed in her bathroom in a little Louisiana town called Manny, Louisiana. A lawyer who didn't, he was cowed, he was totally ineffectual. Let that all-white jury be sat and didn't do the investigation that he should have. And so Dobie's one, and then a man in Virginia, Joseph Odell, who never got a full evidentiary hearing, ever, and had Barry Sheck and an Innocence Project willing to do a DNA test free on the rape kit that would show the woman who had been killed. You know, when you murder somebody, for it to be first degree or a capital case, it has to be with a felony accompanying it. And so there had been a rape murder. A murder in and of itself is not considered the worst of the worst. But if there's a felony in connection with it, like during a robbery, and so rape was the felony or the aggravating circumstance that gave Joseph Odell the death penalty. And here he had Barry Sheck and DNA experts who were willing to do a DNA test on the rape kit. And Virginia wouldn't turn it over. The courts wouldn't allow it to be turned over. Then Virginia executed Joseph Odell, and then they destroyed the DNA evidence so it can never be tested.
Okay. And when you're talking to you mentioned that you've talked to the families of some of the victims, and you mentioned healing process, how do you get them to, I guess, get to the point where they can forgive enough that they can heal?
Well, I'm not the one that gets them to that point, first of all. They do that with each other, and there are groups to accompany them and help them. And the best ones to help them heal are people who have been through the process themselves. So I have met, I've met the bravest, most wonderful people over these years of these families that have been through horrendous experiences and found their way out of it. And that killing the person is not going to be the solution. And so what we need is groups of comfort, support, accompaniment for people who have lost loved ones. Because most people, that was my big shock. I learned when I started going to those murder victim support groups, how many of them said everybody leaves us alone. They don't know what to do with our pain, so they stay away from us. And I thought to myself, yeah, I made the same mistake. And, the first man I took on death row, Patrick Sonnier and his brother, when I heard what they had done, they killed these two innocent kids in cold blood. I went, well, the victims' families aren't going to want to see me because I'm a spiritual positive and want to kill their kids. And I stayed away from them. It was a terrible mistake because one of the families was so angry at me, the girl's family. The boy's family, David LeBlanc's family, the father said, sister, where have you been? I haven't had anybody to talk to, and you can't believe the pressure on us about the death penalty. He said, everybody's saying to me, Lord, you got to be for the death penalty, and I haven't had anybody to talk to. And so he trusted me. He brought me in, and he taught me about the journey, going through that rage and that hatred and wanting to see him die, but then not liking what was happening to him. At one point, he just put his hand out like that, and he just said, then I said, they killed our boy, but I'm not going to let them kill me. I'm going to be dead, too, if I go down this road and have all that rage. And he chose to go down another road, and he showed us all how to do it. I call him the hero of Dead Man Walking, and he is. I'm just a storyteller.
And do you still have contact with him?
He died, but I have contact with his wife. And I'll be calling her soon because the anniversary is on November 4th of David's death.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us.
Yes,
we've been talking to Sister Helen
Prejean,
and we've been talking about the death penalty and her work with as a spiritual advisor with inmates. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about. Something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.